Christine. Today's reading comes from the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah chapter 4. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in the day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What are they building? Even the fox climbing up on it would break down their walls of stone. Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with their heart. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also, our enemies said, "Before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to their work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to their own work. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "The work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us." So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time, I also said to the people, "Have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night so that they can serve as guards by night and as workers by day. Neither I, nor my brothers, nor my men, nor my guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water." Here ends today's reading. I'll hand back to Reverend Ying with his sermon today.
Thanks, Regent. Great. Well, as you know, for the last so many months, since I think the beginning of March, we've actually been undergoing a renovation project. We've done a lot of extensive renovations in this place. If you remember, there was the steeple that cost us $500,000 and that was about to topple over, and then that got repaired. That took, I don't know, 6 months. And then more recently, then we had to do the Christian education, and then now we're doing the work in the main church. So I thought it's important to give you an update what that's going on there. So let's have a look at the screen here. Okay, can you look at the screen? Can you see the picture there? That's actually what's going on, the sort of work that's going on inside the church at the moment. It's pretty cool when you think about it, right? You can see that there. right? Lots of extensive work there. See the, I'm not sure that's the main, that's the back of the church or the front, however you describe it. And then you've got that sort of extensive work. Here's a little sort of a video, you could say, that someone gave to us, or sent to us. And you can see the massive, massive work that is going on. I don't know what that sound is. That's in the sun. It's crazy, isn't it? That's what's going on. Thanks a lot for that. So when you look at it, you see the renovations are progressing quite well, and it's probably quite incredible. But here's the question. The big question, is it really important? Is it really important? Is it really relevant for us? And I actually want to say, yes, it is very important that that work is continuing on, and I think it's something that we should all be interested in. Why is that? Because it affects what we do here at church. As we know, the English ministry is crowded down here. The Cantonese and Mandarin are now meeting up there. It affects the Sunday school. The youth ministry is affecting the youth ministry. And so for all of us, we're actually very invested in what's going on in that progress report. Otherwise, it was not relevant to us. It will not be important. It might be interesting, but be absolutely boring. And it's with that in mind that we then come to the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, or we continue on our journey through the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Because when you understand that the two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, were actually focusing on a massive rebuilding program. At the heart of it was the rebuilding of the temple, as well as the rebuilding of the community. And when you read it, it might be, at best, mildly interesting, but essentially it's quite boring for most people. And why is that? Because a lot of us, we can't see how important the building project is. But when you understand the role of the Old Testament in the Bible, you begin to see that the Old Testament is quite an important task, a building project. It's not just important, it's actually extremely relevant. Why is that? Because we're invested in it. How so? The Old Testament rebuilding project was a symbol, the temple was a symbol, a concrete symbol of God's rule, not only of Israel, but of the whole world. You could say that in the Old Testament, it was the White House of Israel. It was the White House of the whole world. And therefore, to rebuild the temple was in many ways a concrete expression of rebuilding, making God's name great, reestablishing his rule, not only in Israel, but the whole world, and the first step to rebuilding his community. Now, we continue on our journey of in Nehemiah. We did Ezra. And just to remind you, can we have the screenshot again? Let's just keep it on the screen. Ezra and Nehemiah covers essentially about 100 years span. That's the period it covers. And just to give you some sort of geographical bearing, you can see there that that's where the people of Israel were in exile. I see the little green dot down there on the bottom right. And then they took that long, long journey back to Jerusalem, which is about 1,500 kilometers. And that would have taken at least 4 to 6 months to actually cover that pretty long journey. So that's the sort of area that we're looking at. Well, when you come to Nehemiah, Ezra focused on the rebuilding of the temple, but Nehemiah focuses on the rebuilding of the temple walls. It was quite important as a matter of defense, right, and security. And when you come to the book of Nehemiah, right, it can be broken up into two parts, rebuilding the wall, chapters 1 to 7, and rebuilding the community, chapters 8 to 13. We're going to zero today. We're looking at rebuilding. We're looking at chapters 3 to 7. But if you remember from last week, Winston took us back to the heart of God's heart. And what is the heart of God's heart? to glorify God's name, reestablish his rule, and actually bring his community back. But when we start, as he starts that building project in earnest, guess what? The obstacle comes his way fast and furious. It's interesting, you know, that when you pick up Nehemiah in chapter 3, or Nehemiah, we pick up Nehemiah 80 years after Ezra has done his work. 80 years. And you know what? After 80 years, the obstacle, they've been resting for a couple of, they've had a big stop because there was a big stop. But then after 80 years, the work is still not completed. And so we pick it up. But after 80 years, we still find that there's many obstacles. Now, what I want to do today is slightly different because I want you to help me actually think through this passage, right? So I want you to actually pull your Bibles out and I want you to turn to Ezra and Nehemiah chapters 3 to 7, right? We'll just start in chapter 3. Now, chapter 3 gives you the extensive progress report of the building program. It starts in a sort of anti-clockwise movement. You can check it out in Google. If you go to Google, look at Nehemiah's building program, and you'll see a description of the wall that's been rebuilt. It goes in an anti-clockwise movement. Effectively, that building project took about 2 months to rebuild, right? But what I want you to find out, turn with me, when you come to chapter 4, right? You come to chapter 4, let's zero in chapters 4, 1 to 8, right? We've read that out. And I want you to just turn to people around you or even just look at it and you have 1 minute. I want you to tell me there are three obstacles that come up from chapters 4 right through to chapter 6. We're just going to look at chapters 4 right through to 6, right? But just zero in chapter 4, 1 to 8. What do you see is the first major obstacle that Nehemiah faces? What is the first major obstacle? Now, you can look at yourself or you can turn to the people around you, right? But I'm going to give you, we're going to zip through this very, very fast. The passage of Nehemiah is not hard to understand, right? But in Nehemiah chapters 4, 1 to 8, what do you see is the first major obstacle? Have a look at Nehemiah chapters 4, 1 to 8. I'm going to give you a minute, then I'm going to ask you to yell out for me your answers, okay? Now, for those on Zoom, I'm going to try and work out how we're going to do this on Chatland, okay? So I'm going to try and log into my Zoom account. Can I get into join in? And you're going to add me into it, right? Right, I'm going to join in. And on chat, I want you to do the same thing, right? I want join in without video, right? All right, now you can talk to the people around you if you want, or you can just look at yourself, but I want you to tell me what you see is the first major obstacle that Nehemiah confronted as he set about to get the building project. Sorry? To rebuild the wall. Thank you. All right, what's the first major obstacle? Anyone want to yell out some answers? First major obstacle. Come on, you guys. Remember what I say to you Sambalat. Yeah, what about him? Come on, let's go. Keep going. Angry. What verse did you get from Grace? Verse 1. Yes. He was angry. How does he describe his anger? Sorry? Incensed. He was not just angry, he was greatly incensed. What else did we find are there obstacles? How else did he describe this sort of obstacle? They were ridiculed and made fun of. You look at verse 1 again. He became angry, right? He became angry. Have a look at the screen there. Can you get that on the screen? Thank you. He came angry and greatly incensed. Look at the nature of their insults. You have a look at verse 2. And in the presence of the associates of the army of Samaria, he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their walls? Will they offer sacrifice? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from these heaps of rubbles and burn as they are. Timai the Ammonite, who was at the site, said, what are they building? Even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones. So you can see the sense there that what they're actually saying there is they're pretty angry and mocking them. What else can you see? What other words are used to describe what they are facing? What other words are used to describe what they are facing in verses 1 to 8? Can anyone else shoot some answers out? Come on, this is where we come together to encourage each other. Any? They plotted together. What verse is that, Grace? Verse 8. Verse 8, yeah. They plotted together. That's pretty serious. It's not simply you have a rabble of people, right, who are just taking shots at them. They're actually coming together to conspire, to plan, to bring these people down. Where's verse 8? I can't see verse 8 in my thing here. Thank you. Verse 8. No, my glasses are reading, long sighted glasses, not reading. Yeah, they all plotted, they come together and fight again. So it's not just plotting. It's like a group of bullies coming together and let's work out how we're going to bring them together. Look at also verses 4 and 5. Look at verses 4 and 5. What do you see in verses 4? Can I verses 4 and 5? They hear us, our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults upon us. In verse 5, we read these words. In verse 5, do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in their face. It's not simply that they're insulting behind their back, it's insulting them in their face. And it's not just simply insulting, in other words, it says that they've thrown insults at them. So what do you see here? But it goes even further. Have a look at verse 11. What does the verse 11 tell us of what they were planning to do? Have a look at verse 11. Anyone? They were going to plan to kill them. So it's not simply to insult them, to mock them, to plot against them, to bring it down. They are even plotting to kill them. But it doesn't even stop there. Jump down with me to, say, chapter 6, 1 to 4. Chapter 6, how does this opposition intensify in chapter 6, 1 to 4? What do we read in chapter 6, 1 to 4? Any idea? What do you see in chapter 6, 1 to 4? They're trying to what? Harm who? Nehemiah. That's right. So not only were they insulting the people, angry at the people, plotting against the people, if you actually wanted to stop anything, what do? You always go for the leader. You stop the leader, you stop the work. You kill the leader, you essentially kill the work. It's one of the dangers of leadership. And one of the reasons why we need to be praying for our leaders, like our elders, the pastors and deacons, our growth group leaders and so on like that, because whenever you kill the leader, you kill the ministry. You stop the leader, you stop the sort of thing. And so the first obstacle you find here that Nehemiah faced was fierce, angry opposition. Fierce, angry, violent opposition. That was the first obstacle. What's the second obstacle that he had to face? Have a look at chapter 4, verse 10. How would you summarize 4:10? Don't put it up yet. Don't put the screen up. I want to get them down below. In chapter 4, verse 10, what do we see? In chapter 4, verse 10. 4:10, what do we see here in 4:10? Anyone who can give it a shot? The laborers are getting weaker, and why is that? There's a lot of rubble. That's right. In other words, the situation here is that it was overwhelming for them, absolutely overwhelming. Because the truth of the matter is not only are they facing opposition, the size of the task was quite enormous for them. So here's the second obstacle. opposition, fierce, angry, violent opposition, life-threatening opposition. The second thing was it's overwhelming. They say that research has shown us that the walls were actually 4 kilometres long. The height was about 12 metres, which is about 3 stories, I think. Is that right, Luke? How high is 12 metres? Four stories high, and the width is about 10 metres. That's what they're saying, right? That's a lot of work. Now, by God's grace, they were able to get it done within about 2 months. Nevertheless, even on a good day, it's hard work, but what did they have? They had to face the constant threats of their life. But there was a third major obstacle that they had to overcome. What was the third obstacle? Have a look, jump down with me to chapter 5, verses 1 to 5. What was the third major obstacle? What is the third major obstacle that they had to overcome? Sorry? Money? Can you explain a bit further? What's the third major obstacle they had to overcome? Sorry? Taxes? What else? Well, have a look at it. Have a look at the screen there. Internal division, right. Now, the men and the wives were saying, what were the men and the wives were saying? Raised a great outcry against who? Fellow Jews. Some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. Others were saying, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine. Sorry. Still others find that we have had to borrow money to pay the king's taxes on our fields and vineyards. Though we are of the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. So what is the third obstacle that Nehemiah had to face? There was fierce, violent, angry opposition. There was the overwhelming task in addition to that. And there was brokenness within the community. There was brokenness within the community. The very people who should have been there helping them were actually taking advantage of them. The very people who should have been serving alongside and providing the provisions was actually cheating on them and ripping them off. So it's not surprising that that Nehemiah was pretty fiercely angry, right? Now, when you think about that, that was the obstacle that Nehemiah had to face as he sought to rebuild the temple, reestablish God's rule, and rebuild the community. And in many ways, it's not much different to today, isn't it? When you listen to Lorenzo and Liliana, right, the task of bringing the gospel to that nation is a huge task because there's opposition. The task is overwhelming, and there is often brokenness within even the school community. So take, for instance, throughout history, we've seen this sort of task with Christian martyrs. The task before us is enormous, to say the least. We know the enormous task of reaching the world, but the workers are few. I was talking to a university worker who works in Japan, and she was sharing with me of one situation where we had one student worker working amongst 3 universities, and that total a population of hundreds of thousands. Can you imagine that? One worker over 3 dealing with hundreds of thousands of workers. And of course, it's not just the opposition that is always against those who seek to promote God's work, and not over the overwhelming task. There sadly is the problem of the church. We can only think of Rabbi Zacharias, who for many years was a beacon of Christian faith and defense. But as we've heard more recently, his sex scandals have come out in the light of all of research, and that has raised questions. Well, if you've got a Christian leader like this, what hope does the Christian faith have? And it's easy to think that when you see the opposition and you see the overwhelming work and you see the problems of the church to promote the work of the gospel, to make disciples of all nations and to declare people that God is Lord, maybe you just got to give up, is how some people feel. Maybe we should just give up, etc., etc. Faced with that sort of problem that Nehemiah was confronted with, what was Nehemiah's response? Did he give up? Well, have a look at his response in chapter 4, verse 14. As he sees the problem beforehand, what does he say to them? After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. What is Nehemiah saying in the face of opposition, in the face of the overwhelming task, and in the face of the moral and the brokenness of his own community? Is he tempted to give up? Not so. What he says is, don't be afraid. Remember the Lord who is great. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. And he calls upon them to continue that work. But we need to ask the question. When he simply says, remember that the Lord is great and awesome, what is he actually saying there? I mean, it's nice to know that God is great and awesome, but how does that help the situation? What is God like when we say that God is present? When we say that God is powerful? Are we saying that God is very much like a cheerleader, cheering us on from the sideline? Is he like the politicians, many politicians, who encourage their country in the midst of great crisis and great difficulty, but then go back into their rooms and sip a nice glass of wine because their life is cozy and comfortable? Is that what we're saying God is like? And can I say that's probably how many of us think what God is like. But listen to what Nehemiah says later on in chapter 4:20. What's he actually saying? He says, wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet calls upon him to work, join us there. Why? Because God will fight for us. God will fight for us. What is actually Nehemiah saying? God is not just a politician up there in his ivory tower. God is not just a cheerleader cheering us on from the sideline. What he's actually saying is that God is actually jumping into the battle and fighting for us. That is an important thing, that God is fighting for us. He himself has taken up shield and armor and taken the battle to the enemies and taking the enemies head on. So when Nehemiah calls upon them to fight for your families, it is in the light that God is already in the midst of that fight, leading the fight, taking the fight on. We are just following his lead. And the question has to be asked, where do we see that fight supremely displayed? Where do we see God taking on the devil in the most supreme way? Well, we see none other than the cross of Jesus. It's interesting, the cross of Jesus, not just the display of his love that it is, it's not just an example to follow where he calls upon us to take up our cross and follow him. Do you realize the cross was also his sword? It was when Jesus died on the cross, he was also doing battle on the cross. He was doing battle on the cross for the lives of all his people. Listen to these words as we read these words in Colossians chapter 2, verse 15. As Paul writes his letter to the church in Colossae and explains to him what the cross is, what does he say here? Having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphed over them by the cross. Or take, for instance, this passage in 1 Corinthians 15. Then the end will come when he hands the kingdom to God the Father after he has destroyed all dominion, authority, and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemy under his feet. So So what is Nehemiah calling upon his people to do? What does he call upon us to do? And it's very simple. He's really calling us not to be afraid. After I looked at things, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid. Nehemiah saying, don't be afraid. Get in the fight for God's glory, because God is fighting for us. And in the same sense, it's true of us today. We're given the great task to make disciples of all nations. We're given the great task to declare to people that Jesus is Lord of all things, and for people to come back to him. But when you look at the task before us, it is overwhelming. The opposition is fierce and angry, and there is moral corruption even within the church. How can we get on with this task? Isn't it easy just to give up? But what God says to, what Nehemiah says to them is what he also says to us. And that is, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. When we're tempted to keep our faith closet behind closed doors, we're called not to be afraid. When we're tempted not to be, when we're tempted not to talk to that person about Jesus because we're scared of their reaction, we're called not to be afraid. When we're tempted just not to keep our whole faith closed so that no one at church at work knows that we're Christians, we're called not to be afraid. Rather, what are we called to do? We're called to get into that fact and join in that great task of making disciples of all nations, to declare that Jesus is Lord of all, and to remember the last thing, right? And what is that thing? That God is actually fighting for us. So what we learn from chapter 3 to 7, there is great opposition, overwhelming odds. There is often the brokenness of our church. Nevertheless, we're called not to be afraid, to join in that work of declaring the gospel to the nations, and to remember that God is actually fighting for us. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, your heart is to make your name great, to declare that you are the ruler of heaven and earth, and to call people back to yourself. And we see the opposition, we see the overwhelming task, we see the brokenness of our own community. How can anyone embark on this great task, Lord, which you've called us to do? But you call upon us not to be afraid of the opposition, but to join in that task and to remember that you already have won the battle and indeed are fighting for us even at this very moment. In Jesus' name, amen. Hand over to the musos.